This week on the show, the NBA playoffs are heating up. Adam Kaufman of WBZ Radio in Boston joins us to break that down. Plus, Jeremy Klump of NFL Spin Zone with some NFL draft predictions. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome into another episode of Calling It. As always, I'm your host, Alex Barth. The NBA playoffs are moving right along as we hit the end of April. A lot of close competitive series outside of the Cavs. Everybody going back and forth. On the phone with us now from 98.5 The Sports Hub is Adam Kaufman to help us go through it. Adam, thanks for coming on.
Happy to, man.
So we'll start with the Celtics. They looked like they were in trouble as the one seed, dropping the first two games at home to Chicago. Since then, they've picked up a couple wins. Rondo broke his thumb. Gerald Green's come into the starting lineup. But ultimately, what has been the one big difference to you between games one and two and games three and four?
Well, it's those two things, but it's mostly, Alex, the Rondo injury. As Chicago looked absolutely lost on offense, Fred Hoiberg came out and said between games two and three, even before the series turned from 0-2 to tied, obviously, that Rondo pretty much had the freedom to go out and freelance and do what he wanted. The offense ran through him. Hoiberg wasn't all that worried about calling plays. Well, since then, obviously, not having that legit backup point guard has really victimized Chicago on that side of the ball. You know, they've tried Michael Carter Williams. He's been terrible. Jaren Grant has not done hardly anything. They've gotten a little something out of Cannon, who we saw more so in game four. But for the most part, it's the Bulls team that now has to rely heavily, all the more so, on Jimmy Butler and Dwayne Wade, Butler especially. And he just can't do it all by himself. It's a Bulls team that already, at least on paper, coming into the series, was inferior to the depth of the Celtics. And so long as they didn't, you know, have too much trouble in every facet of the game, as they did throughout the first two games, Celtics were going to win the series rather easily, in my opinion. And now I think we're starting to see that play out. No Rondo is equal to Celtics wins, and I think unless Rondo comes back and that thumb isn't a severe issue, they're going to win the next two as well.
Do you think we'll see him again? I know after the initial injury, they said 7 to 10 days, but Rondo has a history, a flair for the dramatic, if you will. Do you think we could see him again in this series?
Sure. I mean, I get it. This is a guy who's, you know, we saw it when he was a member of the Celtics. He's played on a torn ACL. He's playing with an elbow turned the opposite way, basically. I don't think so. Or if we do, it won't be before game seven, if the series gets there. But even then, I just don't. I think there are a lot of people that like to reference his history and how tough an SOB he is and what he's willing to play through. But when it's a thumb injury, and I recognize that you could make an argument for any part of the body being significant for a point guard, but we're talking about a thumb right now. If that's affecting his ball handling, his shooting, all of it, I don't see him back out there. I think the evaluations and reevaluations will continue, obviously, but my gut feeling is no, I think he's done.
So now over to more the Celtics side. Al Horford, for a max contract guy, seemed really highly debated during the regular season whether people wanted him here or not. In these four games, do you think he's proven his worth as a max contract player, or do you think he's raised more questions?
Well, you know what? There was an article written on Yahoo that I thought summed Al Horford up pretty well just in the title alone. It was something to the effect of Al Horford overpaid and underappreciated. I think it just encapsulates who he is and what he does so well. You know, in these four games, game two, he was not good. He wasn't nearly good enough, especially when essentially nobody was. The bench was. The starters were all just a bucket of crap. But in the other three games, he's looked very good. You know, to answer your question, is he a max caliber player? He's not, but he wasn't when they signed him. It's just that's what it required to sign Al Horford. You had to give him max money. If you didn't, somebody else was going to. And so the Celtics did that. Clearly, he's been an impactful addition. You just can't get caught up in the dollars, especially in the NBA with the rising cap, when it's really more about the percentage of cap than it actually is the real money. So, look, Al Horford has had, overall, a good series. You know, his points are consistent. The rebounds, believe it or not, with what we've seen out of Robin Lopez, his rebounds are actually up, and up a great deal, up about, I don't even know, 25-30% from what they were in the regular season. He's distributed the ball well. He's obviously defensively shown up. He's really done it in all facets. So I think people tend to pick on Al Horford for lack of an understanding. They look at the money, they think he's an easy target, but when you, and especially when the Bulls are rebounding the way they are, you know, the Celtics can't compete with the Bulls on the boards, which is exactly why Brad Stevens decided to kind of double down as he did before game three and putting Gerald Green in the starting five. He said, all right, so you think we can't rebound? Fine, we can't. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to increase our spacing, and we're going to beat you that way. We're going to go small. And it's worked for them, and it works with Horford, you know, buying in and playing the five, which is something he doesn't want to do and hasn't wanted to do all year. He's a four. He's not a five. And still has found a way to work.
And you just mentioned Gerald Green. We're recording this on Monday. He had 18 points last night, 7 rebounds. Can he keep up that pace for the rest of the series? And do the Celtics need him to be that impactful in order to win this series?
Can he? Maybe, but I can he in the sense that does he have the ability? Sure, because he's a shooter and shooters can get hot. But, I mean, I wouldn't expect him to. I wouldn't depend on him to because it's look at the sample size. I mean, he's had 18, 19 points, I think, 3 times this year. That was a playoff career high for him. This is not something he does all the time. He's you know, shouldn't probably be starting playoff games in 2017 in the first place, and not to mention the fact that he had the 18 points and 7 rebounds in only 23 minutes. But he can, as we saw in game 3 when he had, I think it was 8 points and a board, he can still be impactful. You know, he grabbed the first rebound of that game. The Celtics got off to a quick start. I think they got out to 14-4 leads in both of those games. And he showed just the fact that you need to draw Chicago's bigs away from the basket, that you have to take him seriously as a shooter, that Robin Lopez or guys like that cannot just live under the basket. They need to come out and challenge him, which is something you didn't have to do when it was Amir Johnson starting five. So Celtics can continue and will continue to use Gerald Green in that starting lineup until they lose anyway, and you know, try and make the most of it by trying to even things out with the bench if in fact he falters or he just won't play huge minutes, as we clearly saw in that game 4. I just think, you know, it's going to come down to offensive balance. Isaiah Thomas needs to do what he does, as you know, he's done in a few of these games, and then around him you need to give some support. This team needs to get upwards of 30 points from the bench, and it needs to get some help out of that starting five. It doesn't have to be Gerald Green. It can be Bradley, it can be Crowder, it can be Horford, it could be 2 out of the 3. Thomas needs help, and that's really what it comes down to.
Now, this might tie into the whole Gerald Green thing, but what has happened to Jaylen Brown? I feel like just a month ago we were talking about him as Rookie of the Year, and now he's barely picking up minutes in this first-round series.
Yeah, I think it comes down to a couple of different things. You know, he played, 10, 11 minutes in each of those first 2 games, looked overmatched, didn't look very good. In each of the last 2, he's played not even a full minute and, you know, calling it a garbage minute. He played in the last possession of the game in game 4. He's a rookie. Every other player on that roster who has seen time in these games has playoff experience at, you know, varying degrees, even if last year was the first time. You know, he's in a situation with Crowder's going to get his 35 to 40 minutes. Gerald Green has emerged and shown that he belongs, so he's going to see time. So when you start to look at where Jaylen Brown fits in, he just doesn't at this moment. That says nothing about the way he's developed this year or where he should stand in Rookie of the Year voting or what his future is as a potential all-star in the league or the fact that he was a 3rd overall pick or any of that stuff. All of it holds true. He had a great year, and I think, you know, will continue to make his impact, and maybe that's not until next year's postseason. But for right now, versus what the Celtics need, especially in this particular matchup with the Bulls, he's just not the guy. Maybe in the next round, if the Celtics get there, we see more of him. But in this moment, he's not ready.
Again, we're talking with Adam Kaufman of WBZ 1030 Radio in Boston. Adam, the critique on Brad Stevens through the first 2 playoff series he coached was that he had trouble managing the rotation. He was using too much of a regular season style, wasn't using the starters enough. How would you rate his ability? How would you rate how he has managed the rotation, managed minutes through the first four games of this series against Chicago?
Well, look, in the last couple of games, he has tightened the rotation a little bit to more like 8-9 guys as opposed to 10-11. But to be perfectly honest with you, I don't care. What I mean by that is whatever works for the Celtics, clearly it worked for them in the regular season to utilize their depth because they're not a superstar-laden team. Quite frankly, all due respect to Isaiah Thomas, they don't have a single superstar on that roster. They have an all-star, a couple of all-stars. I'll include Al Horford in that group, but they don't have any superstars. And so depth is one of their greatest strengths when it's working for them, when the bench is actually contributing. So do what got you there. Do what won you 53 games during the regular season. Take advantage of it. Wear other teams out. Tire them out. Run all of it. And I take no issue with that if that's what is working. Quite frankly, like who – I know this is kind of an easy thing to say, but who are we to really question Brad Stevens in this moment anyway about the – like who – literally nobody. You can't find me one person, Alex, who would have said, you know what the Celtics need to do? Getting killed on the boards, down two games in the series. Start Gerald Green. Nobody in their right mind would have said that. Now, maybe Brad Stevens lucked out. Maybe he's just throwing darts. But it really doesn't matter because it's worked. So if Brad Stevens wants to go with an 8-9-man rotation, if he wants to go with a 10-11-man rotation, as long as they're winning, I don't care.
So we've seen, like we've talked about, Gerald Green step up, make an impact. Bobby Portis for the Bulls has had an outstanding series. Is there another guy maybe under the radar right now that's still going to come up and make a big impact on the series that we're not expecting?
Well, look, I mean, when guys like Gerald Green and Paul Zipser are you know, impactful players in a playoff series, anything is fair game, right? Like, I mean, literally anybody could. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if in game five, Kelly Olynyk goes off for 20 points off the bench because that happens to be the night that his three-point stroke is working. You never know. But in terms of that sort of odd guy, I don't know. I don't see Tyler Zeller or Amir Johnson or Jonas Jerebko having a huge game. But then again, look what Jonas Jerebko did in a couple of starts in the postseason last year in that elimination to the Hawks. You know, so he's shown he's capable. I think any of these guys are capable. It's just a matter of whether they get the minutes and whether they're able to then deliver with the opportunity. But I think, again, when you see Green, when you see Portis after the year that he had, when you see Zipser, when you see Terry Rozier and what he did in Game 3, when you're seeing all of these guys in isolated games step up, who would you count out? I mean, it anybody could do it.
Again, we're talking with Adam Kaufman of WBZ 1030 in Boston. Adam, one more for you before we let you go. Going away from Celtics Bulls for a minute here, the rest of the East outside of that Cavs-Pacers series, which really just proved LeBron is the best player on the planet, it's been close between Toronto and Milwaukee, and I want to talk about Washington, Atlanta. Washington with a 2-1 lead. We'll get a little ahead of ourselves here. Don't want to jinx anything, but assuming the Celtics can pull this one out, what is one thing Celtics fans should see in that series that they should be happy about, and one thing from that series that should maybe concern them?
I think the longer the series goes, the better, obviously. You know, you want the Celtics to wrap this one up in six if possible and have that one go the distance just for the sake of starting at home a little more rested and having one of those teams travel after a long, grueling series. But, I think the big takeaway from that series is you don't even need to use that series. Go back into the regular season. We know the Celtics, for whatever reason, don't match up particularly well with the Hawks, and there's a lot of genuine hate with the Wizards, and obviously a star-studded backcourt there with Wall and Beal, and they've got some other weapons as well throughout that lineup. So, I mean, the matchup that I would root for the Celtics would be Washington, as much as I think the Wizards are on their level. You know, I wouldn't say the Celtics would have a clear edge in that series by any means, especially with the way they played in the first couple of games of this series against the Bulls. But, you know, I don't think either team has necessarily in that series shown great things. I think they've just kind of shown who they are at this point and that the East is wide open. You know, I know the focus is Washington-Atlanta, but Milwaukee's given Toronto a run. Cleveland, as much as, yes, it swept Indiana out and LeBron James was himself, but do we feel like outside of the end result of 4-0 that the Cavs really dominated the Pacers. I don't. You know, many of those games were close. The Cavs have continued to show their defensive weaknesses that plagued them throughout basically the entire regular season. So I still think that the East is very much the taking, and it's going to come down to health in a lot of different ways. The Celtics can remain healthy, which they weren't in the postseason last year. They can get through Chicago. They can then beat one of the contenders, whether it be Washington or Atlanta, and then they're right where we all hope they would be, which is the conference finals. Now we just have to see if it plays out.
Obviously, don't want to get too far ahead, but we only record the show once a week, so had to get your take a little early. Adam Kaufman on WBZ 1030. You can catch him Saturday mornings at 7 with Celtics at 7. You can also follow him on Twitter at Adam M. Kaufman. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Anytime, man.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
Welcome back into Calling It. The NFL draft is later this week. Here to help us break it down is Jeremy Klum from NFL Spin Zone. Jeremy, thanks for coming on.
Hey, no problem, man. Thanks for having me on.
So the Cleveland Browns have the first pick, not surprisingly. And it seemed as though the consensus number one was Myles Garrett. Now some people are starting to double back on that. We've heard Mitchell Trubisky's name. We've heard Solomon Thomas out of Stanford. Who in your mind should be the top pick in this draft?
Yeah, you got to go with Garrett in my eyes. I mean, the whole Trubisky thing is crazy to me. I mean, if you think about it, the Browns had the number two overall pick last year, decided to pass on Carson Wentz, and now they're going to go with Mitchell Trubisky. I don't even think Trubisky would have been a first-round pick last year. So you got to go with Garrett. He looks like the sure thing. I mean, Warren Sapp doesn't think so, but much everyone else does. So you just got to go with Garrett. Don't mess this up, Cleveland.
Is there an NFL-ready first-round quarterback in this draft?
I do not think any of these quarterbacks that are taken will start year one. I just don't see it. I think Trubisky's up there, but I know I turned some heads. I had Davis Webb, actually, from Cal. He's my number one quarterback. Because when you're looking at this quarterback class, you're looking at guys that aren't going to start year one. So you want a project, and I think he's the best project out there.
Solomon Thomas at number two is a name that's been thrown around. Trubisky as well. Garrett, the clear number one. When do we see the first offensive player off the board if somebody's not going quarterback high?
That's tough. I'd say the Jags taking Fournette. Maybe I saw that's pretty popular out there. Makes a lot of sense. But, you know, number two, that's an interesting pick. You know, the whole idea for Kirk Cousins trade too for San Francisco. So I think we just got to see how it falls into place coming up the draft day. But I'd say my first offensive player, I'd go Fournette and Jacksonville.
Everybody's talked about what a great running back draft this is going to be, and the discussion seems to be around Fournette and Dalvin Cook. Personally, I'm a Cook guy. I like the versatility he brings to you. Who is the better? Which running back has the more upside?
Upside. I'd say if you're going upside, I'd go Cook. But if I'm drafting one of those running backs, I'm taking Fournette all day. I mean, I just the thing with Cook is maybe I'm looking too far into it, but Jimmy Kemsky of Philly Voice, actually, he had a really good tweet comparing Lane Johnson's combine numbers to Dalvin Cook. Lane Johnson pretty much did the same exact thing, but he weighs 90 pounds more. So I just don't like Cook with his athletic ability. So, yeah, I'm going Fournette.
When do you see the first, and obviously it's very hard to call this, which pick do you see on the block, the earliest pick that's potentially on the block, a team looking to move down?
I'd say number two. Lynch, you know, the young, new GM coming in, not young, so to say, but you know what I mean, new GM. I think that pick's going to be interesting. I really do still somehow see Kirk Cousins' name getting relevant during the draft. I don't know why. I just feel like it got a little quiet. I feel like it's going to pick back up, but I could see them bumping back into some more picks and starting to build that roster up.
You mentioned Kirk Cousins. We've also heard Malcolm Butler, Jimmy Garoppolo, other names potentially being moved. Do you think we will see not just draft picks, but a big name move on Thursday night?
The Jimmy G thing is interesting. You know, for a while I was saying, Cleveland, why don't you do that? Go get him. And then I thought about it. I actually tweeted that last night. I just don't know if Jimmy G is that guy that's the missing piece for the Cleveland Browns. I think if you trade for him, I mean, what are you really giving him to work with? What is he really going to be able to do? I just don't know if that's smart. I mean, even if it's the 12th overall pick, I think I'd rather build this roster up and then go try to get the top quarterback next year.
Again, we're talking with Jeremy Klump of NFL Spin Zone. Jeremy, you had a tweet this morning mocking Joe Mixon to the Eagles, and that may be the most polarizing pick in this draft. Obviously, Mixon had the off-the-field issues. How many teams do you think still have him on their draft boards?
I forget who tweeted. It was an interesting tweet, but I think no matter what anyone says, I think every team has him on their draft board. I mean, if Joe Mixon's there with the last pick in the draft and he's not on your draft board, I don't know. I feel like a lot of teams are going to pull the trigger there. I feel like the whole thing, you know, it's almost like a PR thing for everyone. They want to make sure that they're not making themselves look bad and stuff. And, you know, that's understandable. His off-field stuff's pretty bad. And I feel like any team would draft him if he's there at the right price, though. I mean, obviously some teams aren't going to pull him in the first and second round, but fourth, fifth, sixth round, you're talking about a top 15, top 10 talent. I feel like it's hard for a lot of GMs and a lot of owners to say no to that.
We've seen it in past years. You had Lyle Collins a couple years ago with Dallas as the example that sticks out to me. Guys who are supremely talented first-round picks that fall. Alphonso Dennard's another one, was projected a 1-2, went in the seventh round. Outside of Mixon, is there another guy like that in this draft where it is a top-tier talent, but you may be able to get him on day two or day three?
None that can come to mind, just because the whole Mixon thing is just so big, you know. I mean, that's what we talk about. I just feel like that's the guy that everyone's going to be talking about that's going to slide down draft board, and we'll see where he goes.
Now, Jeremy, you're a small school guy. I'm a small school guy. We both went to Ithaca College, so we got to look out for the small school guys out there. Are there any non-D1 players that stand out to you in this draft that a team may take? People scratch their heads, but it ends up working out.
Yes, start with a little Bomber Nation there. I appreciate it.
Had to get it out there.
Got to give some love to Ithaca. Give a little shout out to Kyle Woody too.
Best, of course,
best advisor, best professor out there.
Yep.
But small school guy. I actually had the chance to interview Jordan Morgan. He's from Kutztown, which is about 40-minute drive from where I'm at in Pennsylvania. He played tackle all 4 years at Kutztown. He's a massive guy. He didn't test very well at the combine, so it'll be interesting to see how much that hurts him. But I see him as a really, really, really good NFL guard. So I think the team's going to pull a trigger on him. Kutztown's a D2. I think he has starter qualities in the NFL, so we'll see where he goes.
I was watching the NFL Network was replaying a lot of the first rounds over the weekend, and you remember some of the crazy moments. Aaron Rodgers falling to 24, had everybody saying what's going on. Tim Tebow getting picked at 24, everybody saying what's going on. We'll give you a chance to make a prediction here, just kind of out of nowhere, a chance to look like a genius. Give me a moment this weekend for the draft that's going to leave everybody saying, what the hell just happened?
You're going to put me on the spot here, but I tweeted it out. I honestly firmly believe that if the Eagles trade back, I think Joe Mixon will be a first-round pick. I think Philadelphia might take him in the first round at the end of the first if they can bump back. That's going to be my prediction, that Philly's going to trade back in the first round and Joe Mixon will be a first-round pick.
Again, we're talking with Jeremy Klump of NFL Spin Zone. One more for you, Jeremy, or I guess two-part question. Which team has the most to win this weekend at the NFL draft in Philly? Which team has the most to lose?
Most to win. You got to go with the Cleveland Browns. I mean, they're loaded with picks. They have an opportunity to significantly – they can get so much better here. They're loaded with picks next year. It's almost like they just need to really build that roster, and they have a chance to finally get out of that laughing stock of the NFL, and I think that they'll be able to with all those picks. And team with the most to lose, if I had to say team with the most to lose, I'd say the Dallas Cowboys, honestly. I'm actually a big fan of the Cowboys, not like personally, but I like what they're doing, Dak Prescott, Ezekiel Elliott. You know, I just feel like if they don't get the right pieces here, they lost a lot of pieces from last year. And a lot of people think they're going to go out there and win 10, 11 games. And, I mean, if they don't fix their secondary and get a pass rusher, they might not even finish first in the NFC East. I think they have a lot to lose if they don't get the pieces right this week.
I got to say, Jeremy, it is bizarre to see the Browns having a good offseason. And at least from my point of view, one of the best offseasons in the NFL, the moves they've made. Thank you so much for coming on. You can read him at NFL Spin Zone and follow him on Twitter at Jeremy Klump.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth here. Thanks to Jeremy for coming on, talking NFL draft, big picture stuff before we close out this week. Just want to give you my thoughts on the Patriots' upcoming draft. Now, talking Patriots draft inherently is dangerous to your credibility because they're going to trade, they're going to move around. Nothing you say is going to end up being true. That being said, given the current picks the Patriots have, just a couple guys I have earmarked for them. And right now, even though they don't have a pick in the first two rounds, they're not in bad shape. Two-thirds right now, two-fifths, fourth, a sixth, and a seventh. So they have room to work. They have room to move around. A lot of that thanks to that great Coney Ealy trade Bill Belichick made a couple weeks ago. So their first pick's going to be in the third round, 72nd overall. A guy I like for them there, if he's still on the board. So my first prediction, it's a little bit of a reach. I'm not sure if he's going to fall. There's a possibility he'll be there. If he is Derek Rivers, an edge rusher out of Youngstown State now. He plays defensive end in college, but that's at the low D1 level. He's a little bit on the smaller side. Probably projects to be an outside linebacker in the NFL, but this is a guy I really like. Reminds me a lot of Jamie Collins in the sense that, well, his skills are not polished, I guess you could say. He's quick. He's strong. He's lengthy. He's going to give defenses fits. He's clay that Ernie Adams and Bill Belichick can mold. A guy I see them taking and, you know, maybe giving a year or two to get there. They're going to need an edge rusher. He could maybe take a guy like Jabal Sheard, who's gone those kind of snaps, get a year or two to learn the game, and then in that back half of that rookie contract, years 3 and 4, really be a guy who makes a difference, has the possibility to be disruptive. Not great against the run, not great in coverage yet, but he has the physical skills where if you can teach him and you can get him in that right mindset, he could be a guy that he's not going to be on Jamie Collins level, but can be that kind of player for you, can fill that kind of role, which we know how important that is to the Patriots defense. Another guy I like for them in that range, maybe a little later, their second, third round pick, that's going to be at 96, is Jake Butt, tight end out of Michigan. A lot of people had him going in the first round. I like his game. Love his game. A lot like Rob Gronkowski. He's not Rob Gronkowski. You're going to hear me make these comparisons. I'm just using them as earmarks. I'm not saying they're on the same level as that guy, but big body, supreme athlete, strong. Could be a little quicker off the line. That's going to be one of the things they're going to need to work on. But was projected to be a late first, early second round pick until he tore his ACL in the Orange Bowl. And that's why this pick to me is so intriguing for the Patriots. They don't need him right now. You have Gronkowski, who looks like he'll be ready to start the season. You made the trade to get Dwayne Allen, so you can start him as the third tight end, maybe even on IR while he rehabs that ACL. But he can run Rob Gronkowski's routes. You can run him up the seam. You can use him on the sideline. And then if things take a turn for the worse with Rob Gronkowski with his injury history, here's a guy in Jake Butt a year or two from now. Let that ACL heal. Let him get his legs back under him. He could fill that role if, for whatever reason, Rob Gronkowski is not a part of this team's long-term plans, and they can afford to use a third-round pick and let a guy sit the way this roster is built. So Jake Butt, again, a guy, and these are a little more reaches, not sure if he will be there for them when they're picking in the third round, but if he is, seems to have the earmarks of a guy Belichick would like to take, fallen on bad circumstances with the torn ACL, has the supreme physical ability. Most of his deficiencies are coaching fixable. And he's a Michigan guy. He's a John Harbaugh guy. Belichick tends to gravitate towards players who've been coached by those more prestiged coaches, or he also likes the small school guys, just to go back to Derek Rivers. So this next one, I'm going to throw the caveat on this of I'm recording this Monday, 106. I don't know what's happening with Mike Gillisley. So if the Bills didn't match and the Patriots signed Mike Gillisley, just fast forward minute and a half, unless you want to hear me talk about James Conner, running back out of Pittsburgh. I watched a lot of him this year, watched a lot of ACC football. I'm a fan of his game. Another guy that, for those of you unfamiliar with his story, was diagnosed with cancer a year ago, went through the treatment after his sophomore year, came back to play his junior year, had a torn ACL as well. This guy's overcome a lot, but he had a nice season last year for Pitt, a big game player, stepped up huge in their game against Penn State, which is a major rivalry for the University of Pittsburgh, had a couple touchdowns in that one, played well to close it out against Clemson. There was a moment from the Clemson game I want to talk about here that didn't happen on the field, but I thought really sold him to me, especially I think with selling to a guy like Bill Belichick. They hit the field goal to go up late in the game, but there's still 4 seconds left. And as everybody's celebrating, I mean, you just knocked off the number two team in the nation, undefeated. James Conner, I mean, he's happy, but he's on the sideline holding everybody back. making sure they don't run on the field, no excessive celebration penalty. He knows there's that one play left. Does play some special teams as well. Again, not sure if he'll be there, but a guy, supreme talent, has had some issues in terms of staying healthy. But the Patriots, if Gillis Lee doesn't sign again, he can be a first and second down back. He can put his head down and go. Good power, is capable outside the tackles, would be a nice complement to James White, and would replace LeGarrette Blount nicely. You can use him on the goal line, but you can use him a little more as well. Whereas Blount in the middle of the field wasn't as good at picking up those big yards. You knew he was good for two or three, but not much more than that. I think James Conner has a big play ability than LeGarrette Blount has. If he's projected right now as a fourth to fifth round pick, I think that's a little low. I could see him going low third, high fourth, but if he's sitting there at 96 or 131, that Patriots fourth round pick, a guy could see Belichick looking at. Then again, if Mike Gillis Lee signs, not sure that need is there. They're similar players. Don't think you need both those guys on the roster. The Patriots would be full of running backs, and you're not going to take a guy in the fourth round and have, you know, the good possibility that he wouldn't make your team. So that's pending Gillis Lee, but another guy I like just to throw the name out there. Getting into later rounds now, because this is where we know Bill Belichick makes his money. Talked about the outside linebacker and Derek Rivers, but inside linebacker, the Patriots are a little weak. Some guys have left. It's Hightower right now. Behind him, you have Freeney. After that, not so much. Landon Roberts will still wait and see. So another guy who could be wait and see is Anthony Walker, linebacker out of Northwestern. Fantastic sophomore year. Led the Wildcats, the Northwestern Wildcats, in just about every defensive statistical category. Tackles for loss, assisted tackles, etc. But then he put on 20 pounds in the offseason, because he thought it would make him a better player, and had a very disappointing junior campaign. Was a projected third-round pick going into the season. Has now fallen from fourth to, some people have him off their draft boards, undrafted. Cue Bill Belichick. You have him get those 20 pounds back off. Another guy, supreme physical talent, great physical talent, needs to be coached up a little bit. A smart player. That is the first thing you read about him, you hear about him, you ask people about Anthony Walker. Great field awareness. We know how much Belichick loves that. Is great against the run. Not so much against the pass, not so much in coverage, but we know how valuable Dont'a Hightower is to this defense. He's a guy who has trouble staying on the field. Could be a good backup option, a good run-stuffing linebacker for them out of Northwestern with one of those later picks, perhaps in the sixth and seventh round. Another guy I like for them, one more for you, and Belichick's been meeting with this guy a lot, is Brad Seaton, a tackle out of Villanova. I know you're saying Villanova. Here we go again with the small school. 6'8", 325 swing tackle. That should perk you up a little bit right there. Projected sixth to seventh round pick. The guy was a four-year starter at Villanova. He was a team captain. He can play on either side of the line. Could kick inside if you need him to. You probably don't want to with a guy at that height in terms of throwing the ball over the middle, but could kick inside potentially if you want him to. Natural leader, smart player. The guy just screams Belichick. They are going to need a tackle. Now, personally, I think their third tackle is going to come from, last week. Guys get cut on those final cuts. The Patriots generally bring one or two of those guys in, similar to how they did with Adrian Waddle. I think that's where the third tackle can come from. But in the seventh round, if this guy's sitting there with that big frame and the strength he brings, you take a flyer on him. Worst case scenario, supreme practice squad candidate. Those who don't have him being drafted are saying he will be one of the first undrafted players to sign following the draft. Now, speaking of undrafted players, we're getting a little deep here. We're getting a little technical. I'm sorry, but two guys to keep an eye on after the draft, guys I don't think will be picked, maybe late round picks, but the Patriots could bring in a training camp. And I'm talking about kickers here. Now, we all know the headaches we've gotten, to put it bluntly, from Stephen Gostkowski the last couple years. I'd expect Belichick to bring somebody into camp to give him a run. Two names that stand out to me. I think there's only like six draft eligible kickers this year. There's not a big pool, but two names that stand out to me. First one is Adam Griffith, the kicker from Alabama. Up and down, but he has experience kicking in big games. He's a Nick Saban product. He has a huge leg. Not big enough, unfortunately, to win the Iron Bowl 2 years ago. I still have nightmares about that. But a guy like, another one is Jake Elliott, a kicker from Memphis, which is also Stephen Gostkowski's alma mater. So you have that connection. Hit 250-yarders last year. Was 10 of 12 from 40-plus, and never in 144 tries missed a point after attempt in college. Not saying these guys will make the team, but I do think Belichick's going to bring in a kicker, and not just as an extra camp body. I think he's going to make Stephen Gostkowski come out and earn this job this year. I think Gostkowski will do it. He was getting back in his groove at the end of the season before the missed kick in the Super Bowl, but Adam Griffith and Jake Elliott, two guys to keep an eye on as we hit the undrafted part, and we'll talk about that next week of the schedule. We'll recap the Patriots draft and the entire NFL draft next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I want to thank Adam Kaufman. I want to thank Jeremy Klump for coming on, lending their analysis. Again, next week, NFL draft analysis, NHL playoffs, and more. I'm Alex Barth. I'll talk to you next week. This has been Callin' It.
You've been listening to Callin' It with Alex Barth. This episode has been brought to you by Snap Call Sports. Snap Call, the game within the game. Available for iPhone or Android.